Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Innocence of Father Brown by G.K. Chesterton. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Michael Warren Davis, editor at the Sophia Institute Press, which just put out a new edition of What's Wrong with the World by G.K. Chesterton. His Substack newsletter is The Common Man, and he's the author of The Reactionary Mind, Why Conservative Isn't Enough. He joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Mike, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Hey, John, it's great to be on. I really appreciate it. I love the show, and it's an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Now, why is The Innocence of Father Brown by G.K. Chesterton a great book?
It is probably the crowning achievement of the detective fiction genre, which is funny because the Marxist theorist Antonio Gramsci said that Father Brown is actually a caricature of detective fiction. And if you want to talk about Father Brown and sound smart, you have to mention Antonio Gramsci. He has this great little discussion of it in his diaries, where he says that Chesterton is kind of playing off of the tropes that you get from Sherlock Holmes. He says Holmes represents a mechanical thought process that's really common in Protestants and their successors, you know, modern materialists. It's kind of objective and aloof. And whereas Father Brown is informed by what he calls the psychological experience of the confessional, you know. So we'll talk about this when we get to the Blue Cross. But, you know, Father Brown knows everything that he knows about the criminal mind, not because he's you know, smoking crack and meditating on newspaper clippings like Sherlock Holmes, but because, you know, he knows criminals. He lives with criminals, reformed criminals, and he's able to study them up close and personal all the time, not trying to put them in jail, but trying to save their soul. And so Gramsci says that Father Brown makes Sherlock Holmes look like a pretentious little boy, shows up his narrowness and pettiness. And so, I mean, you know, you have to be a Marxist to talk like that about Sherlock Holmes. But I think for those of us who love Father Brown, you know, that really resonates with us. And it goes to the heart of why the Innocence of Father Brown is such a great book, because it is, you know, almost unique among detective fiction. It is deeply humanistic. It is not about capturing criminals so much as, you know, as reforming them and bringing them back to God. And then, you know, having a ton of fun all the while. Chesterton was not only a great, great prose stylist, but he had a real genius for fascinating, engaging plots. So I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
We're going to talk about all that, the great stories in The Innocence of Father Brown. Who was Father Brown, this amazing character at the center of it all, the legacy of G.K. Chesterton, where Sherlock Holmes fits into all of this. I should give a spoiler alert. We're going to talk about a couple of stories and not be too concerned about giving away the endings of the stories. But I will say I don't think that'll destroy anybody's pleasure in reading them. So we're going to try and get a full understanding of Father Brown and these stories as much as we can on this show. Mike, let's jump into the very first Father Brown story. It's the first one in this collection, which is the first collection of stories. It's the first one that Chesterton wrote. It's called The Blue Cross. He wrote it in 1910. It came out in the Innocence of Father Brown collection the next year. And in the first paragraph of The Blue Cross, we meet the head of the Paris police, and we learn he's headed to London, quote, to make the greatest arrest of the century, unquote. What's going on, and how does Father Brown fit into this story?
At the beginning of The Blue Cross, we find Inspector Valentin, the greatest detective in the world, on the hunt for Hercule Flambeau, the greatest French cat burglar in the world. Flambeau is this very, very tall man, right? He's 6'4", it says. And so Valentin is on the lookout for a very, very tall man. And Chesterton says, you know, Flambeau has a genius for a disguise, but no, this is the one thing that always gives him away. He says, you know, Flambeau could no more hide as a disguise himself as a short man as a giraffe could disguise himself as a cat. So Valentin is skulking through the docks and the back streets of London looking for Flambeau, and he comes across this little Catholic priest who's sitting on a boat, you know, warning everyone that, you know, he must be very careful because he's carrying this priceless jewel-encrusted cross. And so Valentin sort of very casually says to, you know, this little priest, Father Brown, you know, I wouldn't be too open about, your valuable load. You know, there might be someone, you know, in this crowd who'd be willing to lift it off of you. And so that's the setup. That's the setup for the very first Father Brown story. You have this great, great detective sort of just stumbling across this dumpy little priest who nobody ever expects anything much from.
Father Brown is short. He's short-sighted, kind of plump. He appears absent-minded. This guy's totally unthreatening.
Yeah. So Chesterton describes him as having eyes as empty as the North Sea. He's short. He's said to have stubbly brown hair, a round face, and then a high and almost childish voice. So he's again. I mean, we'll get into the Sherlock comparisons, but you know, it's this stark contrast to all the detectives that you get. You know, whether it's the very energetic, sharp faced Sherlock Holmes or the kind of hard boiled Humphrey Bogart character. Never at any point in any story is anyone impressed by Father Brown's physical presence, but that just makes him, you know, the perfect sleuth to infiltrate the criminal masses.
We'll get to Sherlock Holmes in just a moment. He seems more like in the tradition of Miss Marple by, you know, the Agatha Christie mm-hmm. character, even Jessica Fletcher, if you remember the old Murder, She Wrote stories. But this gets to the title of the collection, The Innocence of Father Brown, doesn't it? There's a kind of innocence to him. That word means a few things, I think, in connection to Father Brown. But innocence is one of them. He does seem to be an innocent figure in some fundamental ways.
Yeah. And he really genuinely, as a good Catholic priest, he has no real interest in worldly possessions. So when he's going about solving these crimes, and usually he stumbles upon the crimes totally by accident, but when he does, he really has no interest in, you know, the blue cross qua, you know, a valuable object of art. His interest is purely in trying to save Flambeau's soul, and that's, you know, that becomes very apparent over the course of their conversation, and that's what makes him such a compelling character, is his total obsessive desire to help criminals and to see the spark of the divine in them.
Father Brown announces that he's carrying this valuable cross, which is catnip to a figure like Flambeau. He's not going to be able to resist that. How do we get these characters together then, and what happens? What's the mystery?
So Valentin is scouring London looking for Flambeau, and he keeps coming across these strange incidents at shops and storefronts. So he finds he sits down at a cafe to have a cup of coffee, and he puts sugar in his coffee and then takes a sip and realizes that it's salt. And so he calls the waiter and he says, "Why is there salt in the sugar and cellar? And why is there sugar in the salt cellar?" And the waiter says, "Oh, it must have something to do with those two priests." And Flambeau's interest is immediately piqued. Right. And he says, "What do you mean the two priests?" And he says, "Well, there's these two priests, one very, very short and dumpy and one tall and rather striking looking. And they came in and they had breakfast. They had a bowl of soup, and then they left in a hurry." And he says, and incidentally, he points to the wall. He says, one of the short one, for some reason, threw his soup at the wall while he was leaving. You see over time that Father Brown is creating a little trail of breadcrumbs for Valentin to follow. And so this happens over and over again. He passes a fruitmonger, and his signs are all mixed up. And he says, "Did you happen to see any, you know, two Catholic priests come by?" And he says, "Well," he says, "I did." He said, "And if they're friends of yours, and you know, tell them that they have a lot to answer for." And so he's following this little trail of breadcrumbs, this chaos that Father Brown is creating, this to lead Valentin to Flambeau.
And then how does it all come together in the end? Because it's not just simply cracking the case. At least Father Brown has more in mind.
Yeah. Valentin, when he realizes that he's really hot on the trail, he summons the local police, and they find these two priests sitting on the top of a hill talking about theology. Father Brown is, you know, they're talking about reason. he says, this is the word that keeps coming up over and over again, reason. And so Flambeau, Father Flambeau, he's sort of taking a dig at reason, and Father Brown isn't having it, and he starts to push back. Father Brown says, you know, alone on earth, the church makes reason really supreme. Alone on earth, the church affirms that God himself is bound by reason. And Flambeau says, you know, no, that's nonsense. And then all of a sudden he throws off his disguise. And he says, look, just give me the cross. He says, you know, we're all alone up here. There's no one around. No one will hear you scream, and I could tear you to pieces. He says, yes, I am the great Flambeau, and I have deceived you. And Father Brown says, oh, no, I knew that you were Flambeau all along. So Flambeau is furious. He's got this silly little priest, and he absolutely refuses to believe that, you know, he knew. And so he says, how did you know it was me? And he said, well, one, it's because of the spiked bracelet that you're wearing under your shirt. And Flambeau says, you know, how do you know about spiked bracelets? I don't honestly have no idea what that means. Maybe it means something in Victorian era. Maybe that's what criminals wore. And so Father Brown says, oh, you know, one of my parishioners is a reformed criminal, and he's told me, you know, quite a lot about the tools of his old trade. Father Brown says, you don't have you don't have a donkey whistle on you, do you? And Flambeau says, what's a donkey whistle? And Father Brown says, oh, good. So you can't be too evil if you don't know what a donkey whistle is. I hope Chesterton made that up, because it sounds dreadful. And so they have this conversation, right? They're going back and forth. And Father Brown says, but I knew that you weren't really a priest when you started to attack reason. He said, that's just bad theology. No Catholic priest would ever be caught dead attacking the principle of reason. And so that's how he finds out Flambeau, through bad theology. When everything comes to a crescendo, Valentin jumps out of the bush and with his policeman. And Flambeau says, you know, Inspector Valentin, you have found me at last. He says, I bow to you. And Valentin says, you know, no, monsieur, let us both bow to the master.
So it's a crime story, and there's also embedded in it a kind of lesson.
Yeah, Chesterton's stories are immensely fun. But they're also morality plays, and he plays around with the same themes in his short stories and in his fictions, especially Father Brown, that he plays around with in his nonfiction, his essays and his longer works. And the two things that come up again and again with Chesterton are the fundamental reliability of common sense, that, you know, ordinary folk armed with ordinary powers of observation generally know a whole lot more than experts. As William F. Buckley would said, what was that quote? I'd rather trust the first 2,000 names in the phone book than to the faculty of Harvard College. That's a deeply Chestertonian sentiment.
So, Mike, that's almost the exact opposite of Sherlock Holmes, this great detective character, probably the most famous detective in all of literature, created, of course, by Arthur Conan Doyle. And I'll just point out that show number 64 in this podcast series is about A Study in Scarlet, which is a great Sherlock Holmes tale. So listeners can check out that episode. But Sherlock Holmes is this genius. He's super observant. He's super smart. He just awes us with his powers. And that's different from Father Brown, who's perceptive, but he's not the same thing as Sherlock Holmes.
One of the things that's so great about The Blue Cross is that it really is, you know, Chesterton giving his whole philosophy detective fiction. And so Valentin is, you know, he's constantly talking about his methods. And he absolutely scorns the idea of proof and clues. He says, because, you know, false clues and false proofs can be laid out by criminals. And the reason that he's wandering through London is because he has this theory that, to catch a criminal, you have to enter the mind of a criminal. You have to see the world as they see it, and let your eye be caught on ordinary or extraordinary objects that might catch the eye of a criminal. And so this is, as we said before, the total contrast of Sherlock Holmes, who gathers information. He doesn't even actually go out into the streets until it's absolutely necessary, right? He has he reads newspapers. He saves clippings. He'll have his little army of street urchins go out and spy on people for him. But all the while he's sitting in his rooms at Baker Street, doing various drugs that enhance his rational powers, so he thinks, and meditating and mulling over these clues. And that is, yeah, that's the exact opposite of Father Brown, who goes into every situation, who, A, generally stumbles on a crime, but B, you know, goes into it with this wide-eyed innocence, armed with absolutely nothing but considerable rational powers. But yeah, also just this deep, deep understanding of human nature. This is how he cobbles everything together. It's just through common sense and through that purity of heart that allows him to avoid a lot of the foibles that the more judgmental characters like Valentin fall into.
Mike, let's move on to a second story in this collection, The Innocence of Father Brown. It's called The Hammer of God. Dorothy Sayers liked this one. She selected it for her great volume called The Omnibus of Crime. But give us a quick overview of The Hammer of God, this other Father Brown story.
The story follows two brothers, two aristocrats, who live in this small village, and it talks about how the family, like the village, is starting to decay. It has lost its sort of nobility and chivalry, and it's starting to go. And the elder brother is a kind of dissolute dandy. He's elderly, but he's described as having bright blonde hair. He wears, he wears eccentric clothing to draw attention to himself, and he's carrying on with the local blacksmith's very young, very pretty wife. And so the story begins with him sitting outside the church that his younger brother is the curate of, and the younger brother, the curate, realizes that that his brother has been, has been shacking up with the blacksmith's wife, while the blacksmith, very devout, very, very large Presbyterian, has been out of town at a revival meeting. And so he says to his brother, "Don't you ever worry about being, struck by a thunderbolt?" And his brother laughs and says, "Of course not." He says, "Well, if you're not worried about God, then you should be worried about the blacksmith." So then he goes in to pray. He goes into the church, I should say, to pray. And then, a couple of minutes later, he's one of the townspeople comes in and says, "Reverend, your brother has been killed. He's been struck on the head with a hammer." Chesterton is surprisingly graphic in his description, but he talks about how, his brother was where the deceased was wearing a Japanese helmet made of metal, and it says that the helmet, his skull and the helmet were both shattered like glass, but the weapon is this very, very small hammer that seems to have been taken from the blacksmith's shop. Father Brown just happens to be visiting, and so he's kind of drawn into solving the mystery of how this man was not only, in a metal helmet, was not only killed but absolutely decimated by a very small hammer. And as they're settling it, the blacksmith walks down the street with two of his friends from the revival meeting. So the only really likely candidate, the victim's lover's husband, who is a giant hulking blacksmith, is immediately taken out of the running. He's the only person that could have done it. And so this is the mystery that Father Brown must solve.
There's a great climactic scene in a church steeple, and that becomes a kind of metaphor about religious authority and the abuse of religious authority and so much more.
Yeah, so the solution to the story, if we don't mind spoiling it, is that the brother did it, of course, the curate. He's in the habit of, praying not in front of the altar, right, the way that normal people do. He prays in little niches and in the crypt and in the belfry. And so what transpires is that he'd been preparing to, when he had this confrontation with his brother, he picked up a small hammer. He's a weak, kind of effeminate man, and he was going to hit his brother, but thought better of it and put the hammer in his pocket so that his brother wouldn't see it, and then went about his prayers. But then he gets to his belfry, right? So he's high, high up above the rest of the village. And he looks down and he sees his brother teasing the local, what they say, idiot, sort of mentally disabled boy that lives in the village. And he's so overcome with sort of righteous anger that he throws this hammer from this very high height and smashes his brother like a beetle. And so the Chesterton says, so Father Brown follows him up to the belfry, and he's the only one that's figured out that that it's the curate. So the curate's returning to the scene of the crime and to console himself. And Father Brown says, you know, I think there's something rather dangerous about standing in high places, even pray. Heights were made to be looked at, not to be looked from. The moral of the story is that, you know, when this tortured, pathetic, but, you know, deep down, quite decent man, you know, when he's in and among his own people, he's not such a bad guy. But when he's, you know, when he's at this lofty height, when he takes himself to these heights, he's, you know, he it talks about how he looks down at the this ugly sunlit picture of the stupidity and cruelty of the earth, right? His brother's cruelty and the poor boy's stupidity in there. And this is the moment when he throws the hammer, because, you know, he feels himself so much better than, you know, not only his brother, but, you know, also Mad Joe, the mentally disabled boy. The moral of this story is it's about people, especially people who retreat into religion and into a kind of religious aesthetic, a kind of moral superiority, how being, you know, more Catholic than the church, right? How being more holier than thou can lead you to do profoundly, profoundly unchristian things.
Mike, you just used the line, more Catholic than the church. When G.K. Chesterton started to write these Father Brown stories, he wasn't even Catholic. He's a famous Catholic convert, but that's in his future. He's actually less Catholic than the church while he's writing stories, detective stories, about a Catholic priest. What's going on here in his own faith, and why would a guy who's not Catholic turn a Catholic priest into the hero of his stories?
Yeah, that's funny. When I was an Anglican, before I converted to Catholicism, I used to love to remind my Catholic friends that Chesterton wrote his best book, Orthodoxy, before he was a Catholic. It's a classic of Catholic apologetics, but it's actually written by an Anglican. So there's a couple of really fascinating biographies of Chesterton that have been written. Fascinating because the man himself was so interesting. And one of the things is that when he comes out as this champion of orthodoxy, you know, he's already a really well-established public figure. But it really catches a lot of people by surprise that he becomes, you know, he starts to, you know, identify with little O orthodoxy, with Christian tradition. And it's surprising because, you know, if you've read any of Chesterton, he's very much concerned with doctrinal purity, with he's you know, rabidly, you know, opposed to Protestantism, to communism, to the sort of the modern heresies. But he's also deeply, deeply interested in social justice. He's got, you know, he's an equally fanatical supporter of the French Revolution, which is something that correctly bothers a lot of his fans. So he's this incredible, at times contradictory, but always paradoxical figure. You know, that's why we call him the Prince of Paradoxes, not just because he was good at writing paradoxes, but because he really does contain multitudes. And so when he does convert to Catholicism, he is clearly sympathetic to the Catholic Church, but he is already a really well-known public figure, you know, writing in little O Orthodox Christian tradition. He writes a million essays and a couple of books about why he converts to Catholicism. But the one that I always found most arresting is one of the last things that he writes about his conversion. And he says that ultimately what brought me about was not the liturgy. He said, I was an Anglican. You know, I still prefer the Anglican liturgy and the Book of Common Prayer to the Catholic Mass. A very common experience with converts from Anglicanism. Myself and Evelyn Waugh also felt the same way. He said, it wasn't the liturgy. It wasn't this, it wasn't that. He says, what ultimately it was is that I realized that, you know, while the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church look very similar, the Catholic Church is like a statue made of marble, and the Anglican Church is like a statue made of ice. And they can be almost identical from the very moment that they're created, but the difference is that ice melts and marble doesn't.
One of the paradoxes of his life and work is that people who read him today are probably most likely to be reading these Father Brown stories. And there were a dozen of them in this initial volume, The Innocence of Father Brown. There were 53 in total, spreading across five volumes and written across a couple of decades. One of the criticisms or potential criticisms of this work is isn't this trivia? Detective stories. G.K. Chesterton, why are you wasting your time on these mere entertainments? Is there more to it than that?
Yeah. I mean, to defend the detective fiction genre on its own, I think you'd need a greater mind than my own. I mean, the Sherlockians would probably have their own defense. But Father Brown's stories are definitely entertaining, but they're by no means trivial. Because Chesterton really is using these conflicts between personalities to demonstrate real conflicts in human nature, and also interestingly not just human nature but also between ideas. And so, to give a further spoiler, in the second story in The Innocence of Father Brown, Valentin comes back again, one of the heroes of the first story, and in the second story he's actually the murderer. Because he's a rabid French style atheist, and he kills a wealthy American who has just converted to Catholicism, and has come to pump money into the Church of France.
One more question to wrap up, Mike. Maybe a two-part question. How did you discover these stories as a reader? When did you first encounter Father Brown, and why did you come to enjoy them so much? And then what's the case for reading them today in the 2020s, more than a century after the first ones in the Innocence of Father Brown volume were written?
Well, I guess I discovered Chesterton's fiction after I discovered his nonfiction. Orthodoxy and his book Conversion of the Catholic Church and The Everlasting Man were pretty important in my reversion to Christianity, eventually to Catholicism. I hope that every good reader of National Review is also a good reader of Chesterton. And if I can make the little plug, Sophia Institute Press, we just brought out a really great new edition of a really great classic Chesterton work, What's Wrong with the World, published in 1910, where he's anticipating problems like feminism, how feminism would destroy domestic harmony, how liberal infiltration of education would destroy society. I'm already absolutely enthralled with this prophetic man who's writing from over 100 years ago, but it seems more relevant now than he did in his own age, which is why he's more popular now than he was when he was alive, as popular as he was back then. So I eventually sort of drifted into the fiction and to the Father Brown stories, because I loved Sherlock Holmes growing up and I still love Sherlock. It was just a kind of a listless desire to read as much Chesterton as I possibly could, but I was absolutely enthralled with the Father Brown stories the first time I read them, because it is amazing to see someone like Chesterton who can master multiple genres. He's not a great essayist who wrote some pretty good detective fiction. He is he's an outstanding essayist who wrote outstanding detective fiction. And to answer the second part of your question, I mean, that's really it. It's your listeners are probably more familiar with Sherlock Holmes than they are with Father Brown. If you can understand why Sherlock Holmes retains all of his interest in 2022, then you will have no problem understanding why Father Brown does the same. Not only because they continue to be absolutely riveting, not only because the prose is exquisite, better than Conan Doyle's, not only because the plots are so engaging, but because in the morality play aspect of these stories, he's wrestling with the same problems that we do now. Can you reform a criminal, or is there no point? How deep-seated is evil? Is there really good in every human being? Does being a Christian make you more judgmental, or does it make you more compassionate, or does it just, does it depend on whether you're willing to humble yourself? Can you have justice and mercy together? It's an incredibly, incredibly rich array of stories and plots, and truly, truly a great book.
Michael Warren Davis, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Innocence of Father Brown by G.K. Chesterton.
Thank you, sir. A real pleasure and a real honor to be here.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. And last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We're now going to take a quick summer break. We'll be back after 2 weeks off with more episodes of The Great Books Podcast.